You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Today's passage is one of several judgment scenes crowded into what's called Jesus' final discourse series in Matthew. The scribes and Pharisees have just been denounced for their rejection of the Messiah and warned of their ultimate punishment. Then come the examples of the faithful and unfaithful servants, those who have broken trust with their master and those who have been faithful in their service. And here's the big takeaway that is often overlooked. The deciding factor in determining the fate of the judged is the good or evil done to the least of these. Basically, any and all who suffer the hardships listed in the text, hunger, thirst, nakedness, sickness, homelessness, imprisonment. What is not a consideration at all? Belief of any kind. What one believes is a total non-issue. What matters is action, and action on behalf of and with those the culture ignores or leaves behind. As Jesus begins the parable, he uses an image that would have been common to first century folk. At the close of the day, shepherds could be seen separating the sheep and the goats. The hardy sheep would graze through the night outside in the chilly air, and the more fragile goats would be sheltered from the weather. We'll skip the observation that sheep tend to be dumb as a fence post, and goats can be pretty smart. So, in the image of the shepherd separating the sheep from the goats, Matthew sets up a crisis moment for people to wonder, hang on, which one am I? How do I get the good seats at this banquet? And Jesus makes it pretty clear. When we serve our needy neighbor, hungry, thirsty, in prison, we're doing what Jesus expects. Truly, I tell you, says Jesus, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew chapter 25, verses 35 and 36.
For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, you'll find one of the most oft-quoted and watered-down New Testament passages, most often heard at weddings. Love is patient and kind. Love doesn't envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It doesn't rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. Those sentiments are all fine and good at weddings, but fine-tuning the relationship between two people in love is not what the author had in mind. It's hard for most people to grasp, but the idea of agape, the Greek word used in this passage, is about the call to show unconditional care, goodwill, and benevolence toward everyone. Sure, there are other words for love in Greek. Eros for erotic love, and philia for a more cordial, philanthropic love. But the real challenge is acknowledging and living out this radical idea about a love that Jesus taught and modeled, a kind of love that represents the highest, deepest, and most powerful force in human life, that fosters human growth and change, that is the impulse behind empathy and concern, that drives compassion and the longing for justice. And that's where it's impossible for many people to make the jump from the sentimental, spiritualized version of love promoted by the gospel about Jesus to the radical and dangerous implications of the kind of love actually practiced by Jesus. As our passage today suggests, Jesus didn't care who you were or what you believed, so long as you cared for the hungry, sick, naked, and imprisoned. Remember, the peasants Jesus interacted with in Galilee, Judea, and Samaria were not only not Christians, there was never any expectation on Jesus' part that they would ever become Christian as we know it today. Christianity wasn't even a glimmer on the horizon, and yet they were the first ones called into this conspiracy of love. But it didn't matter, because at the core of what Jesus taught and modeled was a very Jewish concept that anybody can embrace, of any religion or no religion. Tikkun olam, meaning the repairing or healing of the world, suggests that all human beings have a shared responsibility to transform the world through social action in the pursuit of social justice. Now, this is not a task just for people of faith, let alone a particular faith or any faith at all. It's the responsibility of all people everywhere. And if Christianity has any relevant role in contemporary society, it's to bear witness to and point people towards this unifying collective reality. And here's the kicker. As long as the church refuses to respond to the radical demands of love's conspiracy, if it continues to lay down belief and behavior requirements for membership in the kingdom, if it continues to mislead people to believe that Jesus' primary message was about himself, then guess what? The conspiracy of love will just get along without the church, thank you very much. Just like it did in the civil rights movement. Back in the 1950s, a Southern Baptist pastor and scholar named Clarence Jordan started an interracial farming community in Georgia that he called Koinonia Farm. He'd often be invited to be the guest preacher in little Baptist churches around the area, and because of his message of equality for all people, regardless of color, he would usually not get invited back. On one occasion, he gave a sermon that called for the United States to stop the practice of segregation. And after the service, a very disgruntled woman came up to him. She was indignant. She said, "My granddaddy was an officer in the Confederate Army, and he would not believe a word that you just said about race relations." Dr. Jordan smiled sweetly and said, "Well, ma'am, your choice is very clear then. You can follow your granddaddy, or you can follow Jesus." Clarence Jordan was willing to let people hear the hard demands of the gospel of Jesus, and if they found it too troubling or offensive, let them walk away. He let whole churches walk away. Same goes for us. That's why the United Methodist Church has let whole churches walk away from our denomination. If they can't handle the message of Jesus' unconditional love, what can we do? Theologian Harvey Cox, famous for being both one of the most influential theologians of the 20th century, and having played saxophone at the fountains, points out that people from all sorts of backgrounds and faiths find Jesus to be both fascinating and admirable. Jesus was profoundly courageous in showing compassion for the disinherited and standing up to corrupt political and religious authorities. But even more than that is Jesus' message of hope for a better world, that communities of love and reciprocity, forgiveness and compassion are within our grasp, even if they cannot be fully realized. And here's a heretical thought. To do what Jesus expected of us as human beings, you don't even have to be a part of a religious group, and you don't even have to believe in the conventional idea of a supernatural God. The author of 1 John certainly did not. In chapter 4, the writer contends that God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. Wait, what? In the original Greek, God is love is theos ein agape. There's that agape again, a sense of selfless, unconditional love. When the author of 1 John writes that God is love, then it stands to reason that the converse also must be true. Love is God. So the word God, even the idea of God, can be said to be a personification of love. Are you with me? For countless thousands of years, humanity has been fixated on trying to coalesce its ideas about God into a meddling, interventionist, supernatural, divine entity, when according to the Bible itself, God is not a loving being, God is love itself. To say that love is God means we no longer have to argue about the nature of God being a transcendent supernatural deity beyond the clouds or an impersonal creative reality woven throughout creation itself. God is instead an immanent reality within each of us, longing to be expressed in our own transformation and the transformation of the world. Love is bound up in and dependent on being expressed by humanity and manifested in what we've talked about before as incarnation. In carne equals with meat, like chili con carne, right? So a lot of people have worked to derail the idea that we are incarnations of the divine in favor of emphasizing Jesus as being the uniquely incarnate one. But the message of the New Testament, the message of the mystics, and the heart of the gospel of Jesus all embrace the idea that the divine has come to dwell among us, not just in the person of Jesus, but in every human being. Indeed, just the way the divine has always been, deeply and unalterably a part of every person. So the good news is that even if you don't believe in the traditional idea of a theistic God above the clouds, no problem. You can still affirm and live by the power of love as a dynamic and transformative force in the world. Love changes people. Love changes societies. And in the final analysis, isn't that what Jesus was on about? If you haven't heard me say it clearly enough yet, let me say it one more time. It makes no difference if God is real or metaphor. Acts of unconditional, selfless love is the stuff of what most people would recognize as holy, divine, or worth giving one's life for. Let me ask you this question. If you could sit down and have a beer with Jesus, although he'd probably order the wine, would you ask this question for me? Jesus, would you rather that I believe a bunch of stuff about you that was made up by your followers? Or would you rather me just ignore all that stuff and do what you taught? I think I know what he'd say. I think you do too. And that's what makes this conspiracy so threatening to the status quo, because it's about action, about transformation, all of which can be accomplished without the help of Christians or a church caught up in misleading and outdated liturgy, doctrines, and dogma. So in the end, Jesus' whole program is not about Christianity. It's not about church and not about belief. It's about acts of love. John Caputo writes, "Where is it found? It's found every time an offense is forgiven, every time a stranger is made welcome, every time an enemy is embraced, every time the least of us is lifted up, every time the law is made to serve justice, every time a prophetic voice is raised against injustice, every time the law and the prophets are summed up by love." Sounds like our passage today, doesn't it? "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me." Jesus calls people, not Christians, not people of faith, just people, to be compassionate instruments of goodwill, engaged in transforming themselves, their families, their communities, their nations, and the world. This is not just a Christian pursuit, but the task of all humanity working together. And our guide to becoming people of the way, Kurt Struckmeyer, believes that this vision of Jesus can best be described in the words of philosopher Charles Eisenstein as, "that more beautiful world our hearts know is possible." Okay, so we know a more beautiful world is possible, but who's going to make it happen? Look at who Jesus called. Not powerful, influential people. Peasants, laborers, untouchables, foreigners, and don't be shocked, women. He didn't ask people to sign on to a bunch of beliefs or commit to particular spiritual practices. He offered them a vision where acts of selfless love and compassion worked over the course of time to transform indifference, greed, exclusion, violence, and selfishness into that better world our hearts know is possible. The essence of following Jesus? Seemingly insignificant actions by countless ordinary people that, over time, transform the world. Some of you may know the former mayor of Newark, who is now a senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker. What you might not know is that Booker went to Stanford University, where he played football, earned a bachelor's degree in political science, and a master's degree in sociology. Then, as a Rhodes Scholar at Queen's College, Oxford, he earned an honors degree in U.S. history. Only then did he go on to Yale to earn a law degree. Well, speaking to Stanford's graduating class of 2012, Booker told the students that his achievements in life were only possible because of what he called a vast conspiracy of love. countless acts by countless people who laid the groundwork for his achievements. Booker said that at his own graduation, his father, Cary, took him aside and said, "You need to understand that who you are now, you are the physical manifestation of a conspiracy of love. That people whose names you don't even know, who struggled for you, who fought for you, who sweated for you, who volunteered for you, you are here because of them. Don't you forget that. If I sit down and start taking into account all the ways that's true for me, I soon get overwhelmed with feelings of gratitude, humility, and grace. I remember back in graduate school in Boston, my tuition and many other expenses were covered, but living expenses were often pretty tight. On several occasions, when I was down to my last few dollars, I remember getting a check in the mail from a loosely organized group of former missionaries here in Arizona who took up a collection out of their meager resources and sent $200 here, $100 there, anonymously, to support various students they knew around the world. And I'll tell you, when you're down to a few dollars in a city like Boston, a $100 check is a huge relief. After some investigation, I was finally able to determine who the ringleader of this group was, but he would never reveal who the other contributors were. Part of their MO was that the donations were anonymous. It was like, I don't know, a conspiracy. Look, despite our very mixed reputation throughout history, Christians have sometimes been a powerful force for equality, for compassion, for justice, for love, and a belief in the sacredness of every human life. But it doesn't happen on its own. It doesn't happen just because you believe the right stuff. It's because in certain times and certain places, people felt the call to love welling up inside. And they just couldn't help themselves. They took the risk to make that beautiful world they knew was possible a reality. As Senator Booker's dad said to him, "You have a choice in life. You can just sit back, getting fat, dumb, and happy, consuming all the blessings put before you, or it can metabolize inside of you and become fuel to get you into the fight." We have a choice, and who we are as just regular folk is not a disadvantage. It's just the kind of environment Jesus was used to working in. But it won't happen if you don't get in the fight. As Margaret Mead said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." A more beautiful world is possible. Your heart knows it's true. And yes, there are a lot of obstacles between us and making it real. Disinformation, pushback, hatred, ignorance, fear, greed, and selfishness. But Jesus has shown us the way. Not an easy way of overnight success, of reciting some sinner's prayer or pledging allegiance to some creed, but committing to the work of a lifetime, of many lifetimes, all working together to make Jesus' vision real in the world. Now, there's only one thing left to know. Are you going to just sit there or get in the fight? Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.